This is episode 21 of the Great Speech Podcast on how to communicate with young people, an interview with Dr. Tori Wheaston-Surden. Lockdowns. Love them.
It's a Great Speech Podcast for the public speakers. We're going way down deep to look at what makes a communicator. We'll look at all different topics from the bottom to the top. So get your mind free of all the distractions and please listen up.
It's the Great Speech Podcast.
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 Thanks, Dad. Welcome back, my great communicators. How you guys doing? I hope you are well. This is, of course, Kolari Leshonaike, your communications super skills coach, let's call me, bringing you another episode, yet another episode of the Great Speech Podcast. And I am recording this, at least this little intro part, in the middle of London at lockdown. Are you guys on lockdown too? It is kind of a strange experience. Although I have said that for those of us who are introverts, actually lockdowns are great because it's kind of, you don't have to engage with a whole load of people anymore. So I actually don't mind it personally. So I hope you guys are safe. I hope you are well. The interview I recorded this week, in fact, was recorded really before the coronavirus pandemic really hit, or at least really took hold. So it didn't inform the discussion that we had. And I wish it had, in a way, because I think Tori, my guest, would have had a lot more to say in regards to how important it is at this time to really be clear on how we communicate with young people, especially when you're in lockdown and everyone's on top of everybody else. So my guest this week is Dr. Tori Wheaston-Surden. Tori is a scholar and a practitioner. She's got, you know, 15 years or so of teaching and youth program experiences, and she's really dedicated her life and her career to teaching and mentoring young people in her community. She is the founder of the Youth Mentoring Action Network, which is a nonprofit that focuses on critical mentoring, as she kind of describes it and defines what she does. And she specializes in particular in serving diverse youth populations. So young Black kids from Latino backgrounds, LGBTQQ, college students, low-income youth. So you can see, and I think you'll be able to tell from the discussion we have, that she is really passionate about what she does. It's a great discussion. We talk about how to listen effectively to young people, of course, but she also talks about how to go further, like what's the next step after, or when you have kind of at least done the listening part, which very often we don't think about. Very often, I think, as adults, we pay lip service to listening and then just say and do what we think we need to do for young people. So she talks about what to do, for instance, when you can see that a young person is going to make a bad decision. How do you handle that without, again, just jumping in and doing what you think is the best thing to do? She also gives kind of three things that she says are the most important things if you want to empower young people. And there's really, really innovative. I love the way she approached that. An interesting part as well is you'll hear it's kind of roughly towards the end of the interview. I asked her a question and her answer was, "I don't know." Now, it may seem strange to you to say, caller, you called up on an expert and you asked her a question she didn't know. But for me, that really enhanced her credibility because she wasn't prepared to just bluff it or brag or just give an answer for the sake of it. For her, it was important to give her best view. And if she didn't know it, she was open to say, "I don't know that. This is what I'm thinking. I'm on a journey to learn as well." And I really, really enjoyed hearing that because for me, it was a sign of her authenticity. So it's really a fascinating interview. I really urge you to listen, especially at this time when we are all kind of lumped together, right? If you are anywhere in the world right now listening to this, chances are you are either in the middle of a lockdown or society is very restricted as we all try and keep safe and kind of try and break the spread of this virus. So it's a great, fascinating interview, huge amounts of value. I'm so grateful to Tori for doing it. We are actually friends. We know each other in the context of when I was president of the 100 Black Men of London, and she and I engaged on the subject of mentoring and kind of struck up a friendship from then. So that's probably why we laugh a lot in this episode. I think it's probably the episode I've laughed the most, even though we're not talking about a subject that is inherently funny, but I think it's just a sign of how much fun we had on the interview. So really grateful to Tori for doing it. I really urge you to tune out the noise and tune into Tori, because I think she's got some great stuff to say. Here we go. Okay, welcome back, my great communicators. As I said, I have got Tori Weston-Serdon with me here. How are you, Tori?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good, very good, and I'm so pleased to have you on this podcast. You and I have known each other for quite a while.
It has been a while.
Mainly focused on mentoring. So it's just, yes, in a way, I like this because it's like chatting with a friend.
Yes, I love it too. And thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on here.
Really honored to have you, actually. Where are you at the moment, actually? Just let us know. I always like to know where people are speaking from in the world.
I am in sunny Southern California.
I know.
It's about 78 degrees and sunny outside. It's beautiful.
Oh my goodness, don't please, because it is raining miserably here in London, as per usual. So I'm very envious. Now listen, as you know, I start all of my episodes with a quote. And when I have a guest, I ask the guest to bless us with that quote. So can you tell us what the quote is, or tell us who said it, and then explain why it was important to you?
Yes. So I actually use the quote from James Baldwin. I am not the object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. And I love that quote. It's one of my favorite quotes I use in training and workshops. And I use it because it just reminds us to think differently about the folks that we're working with. Mm-hmm. And you know, I always use this quote to talk about this concept of saviorism. And since we're going to be talking about young people today, I think that's particularly important, just to remember that, you know, other folks have their own power and resilience and are thriving in ways that we may not see. So I am not the object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country.
I love that. I love that. And yes, I particularly wanted to speak to you about communicating with young people, because it is a subject that I think gets very often overlooked. I think we often talk about young people. We talk through them. Mm-hmm. We talk around them. But very often either don't talk with them, and also in particular don't let them talk and we listen. So I really wanted the perspective of someone who's kind of steeped in that field to kind of help us with it. But just before we get into it, actually, just to give some context of, because right now, it's kind of a bit off subject, but a little bit on subject as well. So right now, I think you guys are having the Democratic primary elections going on. I just saw that.
Yes.
And what was interesting to me was that it seems that Bernie Sanders is doing really well with the youth vote.
Absolutely.
But not well. Yeah, but not as well with some other demographics. So Joe Biden's kind of cleaned up. What is it about the way Bernie Sanders communicates that you think is somehow resonating with young people, bearing in mind he's the oldest candidate there's ever been, right?
Right. I cannot believe this.
Yeah.
I really think what it is it's Bernie Sanders being so radical. When I listen to young people, I hear young people really wanting to reimagine things and really wanting to push things forward in a way that a lot of adults sort of like turn their nose up. And I think Bernie Sanders saying all of these sort of what we are terming as quote-unquote radical socialist that turns a lot of adults off is exciting for young people because they've seen what adults have put in place. They know it doesn't work. And so they're really interested in looking at alternatives no matter how extreme they are. They just kind of want to see some sort of change. And I think that's really what's attracting them to Bernie Sanders.
But how is he getting people to believe him? Because, I mean, politicians say all sorts of things, right? So I'm sure he's not the first politician that has promised things to young people.
Right.
But for some reason, they buy it from him in a way that they're not buying from other people. And I just wondered if you had a perspective on why.
Yeah, he's unapologetic about it.
Right.
I mean, yeah, for me, again, like the reason I think he really resonates with young people is because he's like, yes, this, and I don't care what you think. It should be this. And so he's sort of forceful. He's unapologetic. He doesn't, sort of shrink back. He's not, he doesn't try to be too polished, which I think a lot of politicians really have problems with. And I think young people just appreciate that honesty, and they appreciate that, just that rawness, you know what I mean? I mean, they don't like to dance around things these days. Just get right to it, right? And I think that's what Bernie Sanders brings to them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wondered about it, and I thought that was the reason, but not being stateside, I didn't want to presume. So I thought, yeah, let me ask you. Tori, how did you get into this, right? How did you get into a kind of either the mentoring or kind of dealing and working with young people, as that was the thing that you were going to dedicate your life to, as you have?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you're asking me this question because I'm at this transition point in my life.
Okay.
The reason I got into this work, I wanted to be a teacher. I'd always wanted to be a teacher. I had a really excellent teacher in high school. I thought, if I can be like this, I think I could do this for the rest of my life. But I was also sort of naive in the way that I thought teaching could only happen in schools. So, I went to school, I became a teacher. I've been teaching for 15 years now. And I knew immediately, like once I got into the high school classroom, I loved working with young people. I loved all of the challenges that it brought. But I also loved the richness that it added as well. But I think after 15 years, I also pretty much decided that there's a lot of limitations on the work that I can do in the high school classroom. So, I mean, I'm actually talking to you now. It's March, and I'm going to be finished teaching in May, and I won't be returning in the fall.
Wow.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible to even think about, because I thought that this surely would be what I do for the rest of my life.
What do the kids call you, by the way? Is it Tori or is it Miss? Or
oh,
Miss
they Weaston? Definitely, yeah, they call me Doctor or they call me Miss Weaston.
Oh,
yeah.
Aha, okay.
Yeah, some of the kids are really formal and they say Dr. Weaston, so yeah.
Right, excellent. Do you think you're gonna miss it?
I do think I'm going to miss it. I'm still going to be working with young people in other capacities, but I am going to miss the everyday challenge that the classroom brings, and also how young the kids keep me.
Right. Right. Yeah, because you've got to stay on your toes, and mentally you've got to be nimble, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. So I feel like if I were to retire from teaching, I'd still look 40, when I was 60. The kids would keep me young and spry.
Yeah. So that's what you're transitioning from. So what are you transitioning into?
Yeah. So I'm going to be running my nonprofit, the Youth Mentoring Action Network, pretty much full time. And so I'm still going to be working with young people, just in another capacity. And I'll still be teaching, just, without some of the political and bureaucratic limitations.
Yes.
And I'm actually also, I just signed on to run a master's program at a university. So
wow,
for folks like me. Thank you. Yeah. Mm. So it's called the Community Engaged Education and Social Change Program at Claremont Graduate University. And I'm doing that because it's a program for folks like me who see themselves wanting to work in education, but maybe not in schools, maybe in nonprofits, maybe in government, maybe in community capacity. So I want to be a part of sort of training that next generation of folks.
Right. Okay. So then tell us about it's the Youth Mentoring Action Network, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that in terms of What is your kind of your mission for that? What's your vision for it? Why did you set it up? Why is it still your passion?
Yes. Well, I set it up like really early on in my teaching career. And I set it up because probably like in the first 2 years of teaching, I recognized I'm not going to be able to do the work I really want to do, not here.
Right.
And I started thinking about, well, how will I do that? Like, what does it look like to really be able to communicate with young people, to be in community with young people, to build things alongside young people? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I imagined the Youth Mentoring Action Network. So it's an organization that does mentoring, but our mentoring, our brand of mentoring, as I like to say, is rooted in equity. So mm-hmm. we always say leveraging the power of mentoring in the fight for equity and justice.
Right.
And the idea is that we just provide young folks, particularly young folks who are marginalized, mm-hmm. with resources and opportunities and support. And we build mentoring program that reflects them and what they want and what they need. So we're definitely not the sort of traditional mentoring program, right. But I think that's why it works for young people.
Yeah, I saw your reference in your book that your critical mentoring reference to the fact that you work with, in particular thinking about the minoritized and marginalized group that kind of fit into this almost nobody group, or nobodiness, yes. Mm-hmm. sense of displacement, which you know, it's a really tough concept for people to get hold of. And I wondered, now we start talking actually about how you communicate with young people, how do you, yes. even begin to show empathy for people who are in that situation that isn't necessarily the circumstance that you were in?
Right, absolutely. A lot of it is listening.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know, for some people, it's like, is that it? But that's difficult. That's hard to do.
Yes.
Because listening doesn't just require being quiet and taking in what other folks say, but it requires sort of interrogating, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, interrogating mm-hmm. the context that the folks are coming from and what that all means. And sometimes it means grappling with your own experiences and maybe why you won't understand, what they're saying or why they're saying it. And so, for me, really at the beginning of the program, I made a conscious effort to just listen to young people. And I mean, honestly, I tell people all the time, I think that's why our organization is so successful, because young people really run it.
Right.
And so that's what kind of makes it more powerful. But, I tell the story that when I first started the program and the organization, I thought I was doing all the right things. I did like all of the research, I've downloaded all the toolkits, and I was like, I'm going to create the perfect mentoring program. And then we ran it and young people were like, nah,
wow.
This is not it. Yeah. And so then I had to go about the work of saying, okay, let me humble myself and sort of challenge my adultism a little bit. And then, and listen, well, what is it for you? And so for me, a big key has just been listening to where other folks are coming from and what they need, and then trying to reconcile that.
But I think people will understand that mentally, right? But but kind of drawing that in and being that way is much harder, because how do you advise that people resist what will be the immediate urge, which is you listen for a little bit, you hear and you think you can see exactly what they're doing wrong, and how do you resist that urge to jump in with here's the solution? Because there are people who will listen to this and kind of want to be better at communicating with young people, mm-hmm. And they'll want to get a sense of what does listening really mean beyond, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give them 20 seconds and then I'll jump in. Right?
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing about young people that keeps us honest is they respect authenticity.
Okay.
So they will know if you're not listening.
Right.
Yeah. And then they'll pretty much sort of, I hate to say this, but they're also kind of cutthroat. They'll pretty much just write you off. if you're not listening, or they don't see you as someone that they can respect or deal with, they'll just You know, they'll just kind of dismiss you.
Right.
So really what I talk to adults about when I talk about these kinds of things is doing a lot of self-work. You know, I feel like I'm in constant training to check myself, right? So my immediate reactions to things, I'm always telling myself, doing a lot of self-talk and saying, okay, chill out. You don't need to say that right now. Listen some more, right? Just a lot of sort of practicing listening and practicing dialing back. Because I think with adults, we tend to always want to center ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to want to sort of express everything that we think we know. And so what young people have taught me is that, you know, yes, we respect that and we love that you bring that to the table. But I have experiences too. And I have things that I want to say and I have things that I want to be heard, right? And so if you don't give me the opportunity to do that, we can't build anything, right? So I think it's a lot of self-work and then it's just a lot of, you know, sort of mediating,
right,
wanting to overtake things all the time.
Yeah, there's a story in the book again where you talked about a kid, I think called Cameron.
Yes.
When there was a discussion about Obama's being the first black president.
Yes.
And it's funny, it reminded me when Obama was elected, we in the 100 Black Men of London ran a youth event where we were discussing the election of Barack Obama in the UK.
Oh, wow.
And the question was, does it matter? And of course, mm-hmm. all of us adults were all inspired by his victory. And we were thinking, oh, the youth are going to come in and say such wonderful things. And we were taken aback by the response. So just tell me a little bit about that story and Cameron's response and what it kind of led to as well.
Yes. So, yeah, because Cameron was like really one of my first teachers, right?
Right.
He was unimpressed by Barack Obama and the concept of his presidency. And I'll never forget this moment because like this intergenerational sort of argument was happening with this older black man and this younger black man. And the older black man was just, all of my history and my experience points to the idea that this is never supposed to happen. And now I'm seeing it. And Cameron was kind of like, who cares? He's a politician. You know, like, you know, he has money. He's backed by certain people. My life is not going to change. My everyday life will not change because there's a black man in office. And, you know, I got to see what he does first. Like, it doesn't mean anything until I see what he actually does to change the lives of black people and people in general. And there was just this frustration because the older man kept saying, you're not appreciating the idea that Barack Obama could exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Cameron was saying, I think in the younger generation, like we already knew it was possible for him to exist. What we were more concerned about is what happens beyond existing.
Right, right.
Right. And I think now when we look back at Obama's legacy, like we're still arguing this same issue. Right. And so Cameron really taught me that young people are really thoughtful about these things, that they are seeing things in deeper and more nuanced ways. But because we're not giving them opportunities to express and like the older man in the room, we are trying to sort of impose our viewpoint on them and we don't get a chance to learn.
Right, right. And you said that he was kind of one of your first teachers. So how did that then impact the way you then mentored and communicated with young people after that?
Yeah, it gave me a respect. It gave me a healthy respect for young people and what they have to say. And it also taught me that if we don't, I think that conflict in and of itself taught me that if we don't take time to listen to young people, that we'll lose them.
Okay.
Because ultimately, at the end of that conversation, Cameron realized he wasn't getting anywhere. Excuse me. And he just stopped, you know, and he just kind of checked out and he had an attitude and he was like, I'm done with this.
Right.
And I recognized that like no mentoring was going to happen between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship had suffered because Cameron didn't feel heard or respected or valued. Right. And I recognize that, you know, again, even if we disagree with our young people, there's something to be said about being present in a way that makes sense for them. And, you know, one of the things I say to people all the time is I'm constantly concerned that if adults don't get their act together, young people no longer need us. And I think that's going to be a tragedy.
Wow. Okay. So what's the next step we should take then? If we get down to the listening, right? So we managed to bite our tongue and actually show genuine interest. What's the next step for us as adults trying to communicate with young people, trying to in some way guide them or at least assist them with the benefit of our knowledge and experience without trying to impose? What should our next approach be?
Right. Well, then I think that's when we sort of, I don't want to adultify them, but I think that's where we start seeing them more as equals, right? Because a lot of communication has to do with power sharing as well in terms of how we communicate. Yeah. And so I think that's why young people get overlooked and they aren't heard, because we don't see them as having any power, and we definitely don't want to share any of our power with them. So then that makes it easy for us to dismiss them and not listen to them. So I think for us, really the next step is, you know, after listening, is to think about collaborating with them, which requires us to see them more as equal, right? Mm-hmm. To say, I hear you, your ideas are valid, right? There are things that I can learn. There are things that I might actually consider. And I may not agree with everything, but there's something there, right, that we can sort of come to agreement on, which is what we would do with an adult that we would disagree with, right? Or I would hope we would. It's not happening in American politics much these days.
Or in Britain, to be honest, but yeah.
But we at least have that goal with adults, where, because it's not as easy to dismiss them as it is to dismiss young people. So for me, I really think the next step is getting to that level of seeing them more as being full beings who have something to offer, because then that sort of shifts the nature of the relationship. And then we can say, here's what I can offer in terms of my experience. I'm not imposing it on you. I'm not telling you to do this, but I'm saying, here's what I've endured. Here's what I've experienced. Here's what I see. What can you do with that? Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I think that's a difference from a sort of top down, listen to me, young man. I'm going to tell you what it is, right? And you're going to do it.
I have perfected that one with my children. So I'm working on the other. In fact, it's easy. It's interesting what you said. My son, I was we were kind of working on, you know, his homework, and because he's now going to secondary school, high school, I guess, and trying to make sure he has much more independence. So in the past, with stuff like homework, you know, I'd be right. Okay, you got to sit down, do it at this time and this time, and it was always a battle. So I actually tried the alternative of, I said, okay, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do. You come to me with your plan. And he came to me with this structured plan of, I'm going to play it this time for 15 minutes. Then I'm going to do my cello. He plays the cello. Then I'm going to play for another 15 minutes. Then I'm going to do my work for half an hour. Like, really structured. Then I'll be in bed by 9:15. I was like, wow, okay. And I think listening to what you say about treating them as equal and seeing it as a collaboration, I can actually see how that's much more powerful if we, the adults, are prepared to give up that power.
Yes.
That is the main stumbling block.
That is the main stumbling block. And when I talk to adults, when I train adults on this, I tell them, it's really recognizing that adultism is a thing. You know, it exists. We do kind of navigate the world as if we're superior, and like, especially teenagers are very dismissible, right? Other young people are dismissible, and sort of, I know I grew up with the, you know, be seen and not heard concept. Yes. And yes, right? And like, we were afraid to kind of have interaction with adults other than what we were kind of told, or the ones that we were allowed to have. Yeah. And then, you know, as a teacher, I see that more. You know, I'm not a parent, so I can't speak from that perspective. I realize some of that is about trying to keep your children safe. But as a teacher, I see the flaws in that, because, you know, we get them to 18 and they're supposed to go off into the world and they've had no experience.
Yes.
You know, like leading anything or, you know, doing any real work, because it's all just sort of been dictated to them. And then we go, you've had no experience whatsoever, but here you are going to the world and vote and get a job and pay taxes.
Right.
And they just have no clue what that means, right? And so we're kind of doing them a disservice as well by not by not starting to train, at least see them as in training, right? As
very, very good point. Very good point. Now, one of the things that though still will be in adults' minds is, so, but what do you do when you can see impending disaster, right? So you can see that the decision they're going to make, or they're saying they're going to make, is going to lead to trouble. Like again, thinking about my kids, you know, when we were doing the whole, okay, you can walk by yourself, not holding my hand, and you're just watching as they get close to the road, and you're just praying that they're going to stop. And you know, at some stage, you're just going to, no, I can't take the risk, and you grab them. So how do you deal with the, I can see what you're thinking of doing is going to lead to problems, disaster, whatever.
Right.
Do we just let that happen? Is there a way we can approach guiding them past it? Any thoughts on that?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So this is where I think, you know, having a community of elders is particularly important, right?
Okay.
Because then we all get to play different roles. I mean, I would sort of expect a parent to just make the decision and intervene, because that's what parents do. Like that's their job, is to love their kids and keep them safe. And, you know, sometimes we're wrong, or parents can be wrong, but still it's, you're in that position of authority and that's your role. Right.
Yeah.
But this is where I tap into the community of elders, because parents have that role, but where do young people sort of get maybe a more neutral sounding board? That's why I'm an advocate of mentoring, right?
Okay,
because there should be someone who's not in a position of actual authority,
right?
Who could be more of a sounding board, who could be more of a softer voice of guidance,
gotcha.
Right? Who could just say, well, you know, try that when I was 16, didn't work out for me. You know, these were all the problems I had. And sometimes young people are more open to listening to them because that isn't, you know, it's not their parent, right? And I also think too that we have to recognize as adults that the reason we're older and wiser is because we got the opportunity to make a lot of mistakes and figure out why those things were wrong.
Yes.
And so sometimes we have to allow our young people that grace. So, you know, some of what I'd say, we hire young people as employees all the time in my organization. And one of the things I tell them is that this is going to be like the only time in the professional world where you're in a completely safe space to make mistakes and fail, because we're all here to support you and guide you and provide you with opportunities. Once you get that, you know, sort of top tier job and, or you know, into your career field and you're at a certain age, it's going to be harder and harder to make mistakes, right? But now you're in the safe place where you get to sort of figure it out, right? And so we have to allow young people that space and that grace and recognize that, like, even though we can see, like, they're going to go in toward that wall, they're going to hit that wall. Sometimes you don't stop them from hitting it. Sometimes you watch them hit it and you're just there to pick them up.
Right. Okay. So being that support network, but allowing them the space to fail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I think we forget that I always say that when you look back at your own life, you realize,
yes,
actually I did all of these things. Like I remember climbing trees as a kid,
really
tall trees, like right high. And now I watch my kids, you know, climb trees, and my heart's in my mouth watching. So I think I get what you mean, that there's a real we've got to be prepared to allow them the space to plot their own path and experience and learn from their
even,
whether it's mistakes or not, but to learn from their own experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't it better to have an adult there who cares about you to help you process that?
Yeah.
Than it is to just sort of stumble and fall and in the dark and try to make sense of it for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. That's very important. If you ever have any tips on how to deal with moody pre-teenage girls as well, let me know, because my daughter's definitely entering that phase. And you know, so for me, it's much easier with my son, because you know, boys, they just like, you know, they want to challenge authority. So it's, you know, hey, I know where you're coming from. You know, with my daughter will say yes, daddy. And I'm like, no, I was expecting a fight. You know? But then we'll go into a different mood. So I'll pick your brain separately on any tips to deal with a young girl.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. One other thing I wanted to get your perspective on, which is something that I saw when I was mentoring, actually, and we would do things like have workshops with kids and ask for their perspective on things. We would ask things like, okay, what should be the penalty for some crime or something? And we would find that very often the young people were far harsher on misconduct or crime or whatever than even adults were. Is that something you've mm-hmm. noticed as well?
Absolutely, they tolerate no foolishness.
Right. Why do you think that is? It surprised us.
Yeah, it surprises me too, actually, and I'm not sure I can figure that one out. You know, because we're talking a lot right now at our organization about restorative justice, because, you know, that's something that people care about and it's meaningful, especially for communities of color. And my young people, like, they just have no qualms about shutting people down and saying that was wrong and that sucks and you need to go. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I have the answer. I don't know quite why. I think, you know, from what they express to me, they feel like people should know better.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And they say, you know, if it's a mistake of not knowing, not understanding, then we can educate and we can deal with that. But we can't deal with people who know better and won't do better.
So in a way, they are truer to the ideals that we say they should have than even yes. we are, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good question. And then one, sorry, I'm kind of jumping a little bit around because there's so much that I know that you do and have done. So I'm trying to pick on things. One thing, I think it was from your TED talk, you talk about giving children or young people, I think it was voice, power, and choice.
Yes.
I wondered if you could just expand on that and what that means.
Yeah. So voice, power, and choice, again, came from trying to create a youth-centric organization and trying to figure out what that meant, right? Mm-hmm. And it first meant, again, like we talked about earlier, listening to young people, but also just making sure that young people knew they had a voice. So, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, we're here to listen. And it's another thing to actually empower young people to say, no, this is as much your organization as it is everyone else's. And so your voice really matters here. And then outside of voice, just actually, again, back to the idea of sharing power, actually saying, when you say something, or when you tell us what you need, we're going to do it. Right. So like there's actual, you know, power in what you tell us. And then again, just presenting them with choices, with opportunities, with different options. Right. For me, again, that became particularly important just because I recognized that young people were shut out of their own services. So it'd be like a bunch of adults sitting around saying, here's what we're going to do to young people. and then, you know, not really considering, oh, this is for them. And so, you know, I heard this example when I think it was a local politician was talking about building a youth center, mm-hmm. and all the adults in the community, like, were super upset that they weren't consulted. And, you know, he said to them, well, if I build a center, you know, for elders, am I going to ask the 13-year-olds in the community what right. they want in that center?
Yeah.
You know, no, I'm going to ask, you know, the population that I'm serving. And so for me, that's where that came from, is we can't move as a youth serving organization and not have youth telling us how to move.
Gotcha. And in the work that you do, because you deal with, do you mentor kids of all races, or is it particularly Black kids? What about kind of LGBTQ? Mm-hmm. There's an extra Q now, right? Trying to make sure I get, yeah. Do you mentor kids as well from all kind of sectors of society?
Yeah, so we always say that we will mentor any young person who wants it. Yeah. But just kind of based on the way in which we operate and move, we definitely tend to have more marginalized young people. So folks of color, brown folks or Latinx, Black folks and definitely LGBTQQ or queer youth. And that's mostly because, back to the voice, power, and choice, they don't have a lot of options in other programs. So they know that this is a program where they're going to get to build what they want. And so they're attracted to that.
And do you find any differences in either the way they communicate or the way you have to communicate with them? Or do you feel that it's kind of universal, kids are kids, no matter what?
You know what? I would like to say kids are kids, but it isn't true. I mean, I think there is a universality about youth, mm-hmm. but I think when it comes particularly to marginalized groups, they have been less empowered.
Okay.
So what I do find is that it does take almost some foundational work to get them to recognize that they do have power. And to try to sort of guide them and teach them how to use that power.
Okay.
Once they step into it, you can't stop them, right? but because traditionally they haven't been given choices, especially in schools and in other places, it's almost like a little bit of a shock when they first come in. Like, wait, I get to choose this, or I get to, you know, speak up if I don't like this.
What's the catch?
Yes, exactly. And then we say, yes, you know, like, this is your program. This is what this means. So I think that is one of the difference, because when we have worked with white and middle to upper class kids, mm-hmm. they tend to already feel like they own the program.
Right.
And so there isn't any sort of work that has to go into it. In fact, it requires us to have to balance things, right? just to make sure everyone feels that they have space.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow, this is great stuff, Tori. You know, I could talk to you about this for ages, hours.
I know, I'm excited.
I know, but I want to respect your time on it. Just one kind of final question on this, which is, what do you think your superpower is in terms of this? You know, because I've seen your work, I've seen you talk lecture, I watched your TED talk, which I loved, I've read your book.
Thank you.
I always follow the stuff that you do, and it's not everyone that can say, yeah, I work with kids and they are making the connection. You know, there's a lot mm-hmm. of people, I'm afraid to say, that I think work in that space that are doing it because it's a job, right?
Yeah,
you're doing it from a sense of passion, quite obviously. So what do you think is your superpowers and why you have risen the way that you have, made the moves that you have?
Yeah, you know what I'm learning about myself is, this is a really difficult question.
Oh yeah.
what I'm learning about myself is that I'm a connector.
Okay.
And I don't think that I even realized, you know, even when I called us the Youth Mentoring Action Network, mm-hmm. I don't even think I had made sense of that language, and now I realize how important that language is. But I think my superpower is just being able to connect to people, to be able to sort of leverage those connections to, you know, to build a wider network. I mean, even in my conversations and meetings with you, and, like, you know, we're in two completely different places, but just the idea that we were able to connect and talk and exchange ideas, and, you know, that I can inbox you and say, hey, we're going to be in London and we're doing this thing. I find myself doing that all the time. And then over years, I see that the superpower has made a super network that I can call on to do cool things. And I'm recognizing how much that's paying off now. I don't think I recognized it early on in my life. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, you know what? I wish you all the blessings, the luck, everything to make
what you are
kind of moving into and building a success, not just because the world needs it and young people need it, but actually also personally for you as well. I love your spirit.
Thank you.
The way you approach everything with passion. So I really, really wish you all the best.
I appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
That means a lot to me.
Excellent. So listen, Tori, that's fantastic stuff. I will share, and if you're listening to this, make sure you guys scroll down and see the show notes, because I'll share all the links to your book, to your TED Talk, to your the website for your organization as well, so that people can kind of get to know you better when they choose to. But what we're going to do now, as we always do in my podcast, is move on to my 10 question quick fire round, right? So there's just a little bit of fun, just to give people a bit of a sense of who you are in a kind of non-difficult way. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just quick, instinctive responses to 10 questions. Are you ready?
Okay.
Question number one. Name one young person in history, dead or alive, that you would most like to meet.
Oh, Stokely Carmichael.
Oh, why?
Because he's radical.
Yes, that is.
And I love that about him. Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, love that. On question number two, on a scale of 1 to 10, how nervous do you get before a speech?
Oh, 8.
Oh, wow. That's quite high.
I get really nervous, yes. And I've had to do a lot of things. Yes, I get really nervous. I have to have this whole pattern of like getting in my head and getting myself together.
And was that including for the TED Talk?
Oh, that was the worst. I want to talk to you about that after we leave.
All right. You see, it's funny. I always say that to people, because I say I watch it. You wouldn't have a clue that there was a single flutter of nerves. And so often that's the case with people. But yeah, no, we'll talk about that. Okay, question three. One leader in your mind, living or dead, that knew how to talk to young people or talk with young, communicate with young people.
That's a hard one. Ooh.
I always throw at least one kind of one that gets an
yes.
You can come back to it if you want, but if anything pops up in your head.
Yes, I'm going to come back to that one.
Okay. All right. Okay. Keep that in mind. You can come back to it. You only get one pass, though.
Yes. You threw me when you said young people. That's why.
Yep. Okay. Question four. Love, wealth, or happiness? If you could only choose one, which would it be?
Love.
Yeah, come on.
Every time.
A gay girl would be happy to hear that as well. That's the right answer.
Yes.
Okay. Question five. If you had to relive one day for the rest of your life, like Groundhog Day, what day would that be?
Ooh. I think any day that I'm with my entire family together.
Nice.
So maybe like a Thanksgiving or Christmas. My family is so fun. So if I could just do that over and over, I would love that.
Wonderful. Excellent. Okay. Question six. If you could only listen, speak, or see, which would you choose?
See.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I don't think anybody has said anything else so far, so you seems to be the popular one. Question seven. Favorite yes. album, favorite book, favorite movie? Album, book, Ooh. Movie.
Okay, so right now, my favorite album is Black Habits by D Smoke. Love it.
Oh, don't know that at all. Okay, you'll have to share a link.
Yeah, new hip-hop artist. He's amazing. All right.
Okay, cool. Well, I've got my Spotify subscription now, so I'll head straight on to that. A book?
Yes, absolutely.
A book?
Yes. These are hard because I read all the time. I think I would say... but I would say Dr. Bettina Love's We Want to Do More Than Survive.
Oh, okay. All right. Don't know that one. I'll have to look at that as well. Okay, cool. Movie.
That's a good one.
Movie.
You're going to laugh, but one of my favorite movies, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. The original one, not the new one.
Thank you. Okay. Now, we would have had a problem if you'd said the latest one with Johnny Depp, but the original...
No,
absolutely superb. Gene Wilder in great form. Yep. Question eight. Three words that Gail would use to describe you.
disorganized. probably overwhelmed. I'll give her one positive one. She would say that I'm sweet. I'm kind.
There you go. We're going to ask that afterwards. Okay, question nine. What was the favorite, your favorite period of life? Education, kind of school, college, early work life, or now?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I am having a good time now, but high school was super fun. I loved high school.
Cool.
Yeah, but no responsibilities.
Yeah. Yep, that's definitely a good one. Okay, and final question, question 10. Who would play you in the movie of your life?
Oh, man. I like Queen Latifah.
Oh, no, that is a good answer. I can see that. Yes. she's good as well, Queen Latifah. She's really, really nailed the acting. So, yeah. Okay, cool. Thank you very much. That was the quick fire 10 question round. Oh, no. We've got to come back to which question did you skip?
Oh, yes.
A leader that knows how to talk young to person. Young people.
Yeah. You know who I'm going to say? I'm going to go with Marion Wright Edelman. She's an activist. But she does children's work, and I think she's an amazing youth communicator. So I'd pick her.
All right. Excellent. All right, cool. So now you have completed the 10 question round.
Yes.
Thank you for that. So yeah,
it's
just to get a slightly different perspective, just get to know you a little bit better. If people do want to know about you, what's the best way they should kind of learn more about you? Where's the best way to connect with you?
Yeah, I think I would like to send them to our website, eman.org. So YMAN.org. And that's where you can become familiar with me and all the cool work that we're doing there.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, and that will be in the show notes as well, so people can click on that. Tori, listen, fantastic interview with you. Really good value stuff. I'm going to listen back to this, actually, and just kind of drink in all the value and start applying some of that in my life as well, as I'm sure many of our listeners will as well. So listen, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Listen, I always say goodbye in a different language, as you know. So when I have a guest, I give that privilege to our guests. So tell us the language or dialect, and then tell us what it is.
I'm going to just go with what my young people say, and they'll say a variation of something like, peace out, fam.
Love it. Okay, right. Thank you, my great communicators, for listening to this podcast episode with Tori. It's been wonderful. Hope you have gotten good value from that, and we will go out with a peace out, fam. With Tori. Thank you guys for listening. See you on the next episode.